After a mother gives birth in Korea, she is immediately rushed to her bed, covered with blankets and kept warm. She is given seaweed soup made with a strong beef bone broth. The seaweed is meant to give her strength. It is your mother who is meant to make you this soup. She will wash the seaweed again and again to wash away the grit of the ocean. Every year on your birthday, you drink the soup in honor of your mother's suffering. It is mother's soup. I remember that on my birthday, my mother would make seaweed soup for me. She would soak the strands of dried seaweed carefully picked from a Korean supermarket. I'd watch her boil the beef stock as she washed the seaweed again and again. And when I tasted it, I felt like I could taste the ocean. I was also born by C-section. My mother told me I was clinging to her. I was born over a month late. The doctor cut my mother vertically, the way you would slice a melon. Growing up, I had thought the scar was beautiful. It reminded me of a braid woven along her body. My scar is horizontal, the length of a hand along my hip bone. It heals and fades to a raised pink line, the color of a shell. When the midwives brought Kato to me, he was red-faced, with a full head of dark hair. He looked at me with alert, round eyes, as though he knew who I was already. I didn't feel a rush of love or an overwhelming weight of responsibility, emotions that I had been expecting. Instead, I felt curious, like I had just been introduced to a stranger. He was a creature, an idea, not even human yet, just a being, a life. The nurse helped unfasten my hospital robe and put him on my chest. I felt a rush of living, of being alive in the moment, suspended. My stomach was the shape of a square. The doctors had pressed on the uterus to tighten it. Around me, I heard women crying and the faint sounds of mewling babies. "Hold him for a while," the nurse said, and I held him, close. I could feel his breath against my skin. His tiny hands were clutching for me, as though he knew that we had been cut apart. I hummed to him, hoping the vibrations would soothe him. James was standing next to me, taking deep breaths, his hand on my shoulder. Kato was so small, he felt so fragile in my arms, like he didn't belong in this world. His hair was dark, the color of night, so dark it had glints of silver and red, and he looked up at me with eyes unblinking. His eyes had a depth, a dimension beyond oceans. He looked at me without any expression. I looked back at him in wonder. I thought we would be going home soon, but we had to stay for another week in the hospital so that Kato could finish a course of antibiotics. The doctors were worried that he had developed an infection from my sepsis. They were taking precautions. The labor ward was a bright room of 8 beds separated by plastic curtains. It was a cacophony of mothers and babies. Each day, the doctors came by with clipboards and told me that I could leave. And each day, I would pack up our things, only for them to extend our stay. I had a catheter, but no one had told me that it needed to be removed straight away, and someone had forgotten to remove mine. I ended up buzzing for a nurse to change the bag of urine. "You still have the catheter in?" she asked. "It needs to be taken out now." I spent the next day trying to pass urine, feeling panicked because it wasn't happening, and sure that my bladder was going to explode. I was so constantly being groped and poked and told to do skin to skin that I eventually just took off my clothes and sat on the bed with the baby on my chest. I felt mammalian, there to exist, just to do what I had been told. My scar burned. I could feel it, a broad slash across my abdomen. I could feel the metal wiring stitching it together. Sometimes I wanted to touch it, the way we want to examine an open wound, but I refrained. It hurt to sit up, and each time Kato leaned on me, my stomach would form into a different shape, developing sharp corners. I had thought I would reclaim my body after birth, but instead it was now a tool, something to sustain life. My physical self was just to give, to provide sustenance for this new being. It was more than draining. My body, my mind, everything was focused on Kato. In the blur of those hours, I stopped thinking of myself as having a name. I was a body. I had no identity. I was just a number on the marker board and a set of vitals. A nurse came every hour to take my blood pressure and heart rate, which she would mark wordlessly on a chart, sweeping the curtains behind her as she left. It felt like every few moments those curtains were being opened, and a new face would arrive and ask me what I was doing and how I was doing it. Next to me, through the curtains, I could hear some of the women crying. "I'm not an animal," one of them said. "Why aren't you listening to me?" another said. I was sympathetic. Our identities had been overwritten. Each of us had brought a new life into the world, but we were all the same in this shared experience. I rarely saw the other mothers. They were just voices to me. I knew them by their moaning, by the sound of their quiet cries. Sometimes we would pass each other in the halls, taking small, painful steps in our paper slippers, and we would nod to each other, knowing that we were bleeding. We were in this place, waiting to leave. It was another suspended place, and we were here, just existing. Time was marked by feeding and not feeding, punctuated by medication times, which I could tell were approaching when the sharp aches in my body became almost unbearable. I could hear the rattle of the medication cart and the midwife who measured out the pills in small plastic cups. I could hear the woman in the bed next to mine sobbing while waiting for it to arrive. "You can go to her first," I said. The midwife looked at me and shook her head. "Everyone has their turn." The days passed in rotation, feeding, not feeding. I lost track of the days and nights. It was just a continuous blur. Cato would scream and scream in hunger, insistent, primal. Feeding was relentless. It would take an hour of wrestling just to get Cato to latch on, and then the moment he stopped, it would only be time for him to be fed again. My body ached. My scar was a searing brand on my body, and my breasts were swollen and raw. I wore compression socks, tightly wrapped around my legs. My feet swelled up as though filled with water. I didn't leave the ward, but James came in and out from the outside. He brought back trays of sushi and cold beer. We made a toast to the baby, our own private celebration. At night, the lights were kept on, and I could hear the sound of the machines and the faint whir of the lights. I grew used to the sound of the curtains opening, and the footsteps of the nurses who came in to do their checks, and the sounds of babies crying, which was constant. It was cold, the heater was broken, and the vents were pouring out freezing air. Cato was in a small plastic cot next to me. I would lie on my side and stare at him, wrapped in his hat and swaddled in a blanket. He had his fists tucked under his chin, escaping from the swaddle, as though he was in a boxing stance, ready to take on the world. He wasn't sleeping. He shivered in his hat and looked at me with his round eyes. "We're in this together," I said to him. "I felt like we were prisoners, but we will escape the ward," I said. I would reach a hand over to him, but the cot was too far away, and I knew that getting out of bed would hurt. So instead, I would watch him struggle in his swaddle, crying and crying, insistent and desperate, and after a while, I would maneuver myself out of bed and gasp in pain when I bent over to lift him. I would turn the lever of the bed to be upright so that I could sit up with Cato in my arms. I would pinch myself to stay awake, and I would whisper stories to Cato while he slept. I would tell him the Western fairy tales, the ones I loved best, but then I'd find myself telling him the stories my mother and my grandmother used to tell me. I told him about the rabbit who tricked the king who wanted to eat his liver, the woodcutter who trapped a sky maiden, only to have her leave with their children, taken back to the sky in a stream of ribbons. I told him the stories of sacrifice, of a love so true that it could only cause pain. I wondered how my grandmother had told my mother these stories. Could she have guessed that they would be told again, except this time in another language, crossing two oceans, to an old world? As I looked at Cato in my arms, all the hope we had in this one life, I thought of Drew's mother. At one time, he must have seemed like this, uncorrupted, pure. She must have whispered stories to him and promised him her love. She must have dreamed of his future. She must have seen oceans in his eyes. Sometimes, if Cato wouldn't sleep, I would put on my paper slippers and wander the halls with him, wrapped in a blanket. I would hold him close to me, pacing the lighted corridors. We could hear the buzzing of the lights, the murmurs of babies and nurses. As we walked, I could feel my heart beating against his body, and I wondered whether he was starting to feel alone. His world was just expanding. With each step, there was more to see, more to discover, more to fear. We were released just as night fell on a Friday. It was a little over a week since I had checked into the hospital. I felt triumphant. It was exhilarating to finally leave the ward. I stood on the street and listened to the rush of cars, to the sound of the city. I wanted to scream in the pure exhilaration of it. James hugged me. He was holding Cato, and we looked at each other in dismay. They were letting us leave for this human creature. What were we meant to do now? We sat in the cab. Cato buckled into the car seat. "Congratulations," our cabbie said. He promised to go slowly, and he grinned, excited to be driving a newborn. "So, Mom, how does it feel?" I didn't have a clear answer. I stared into the city night. The lights felt sharper, the air felt clearer. It was like a world had unfolded in front of me. I was suddenly a mother. When had that happened? In what moment? I looked at Cato. His eyes were open, wide and reflecting lights from the car window. His fingers were curled, grasping at the air. It made me think of Teddy, his eyes round as he waited for the moon, and I felt something like a weight press deep against me. This was permanent. This was real. I was bound to Cato by a deep sense of responsibility. My identity was no longer my own. It was as though I had transformed without knowing it, and without any warning that I would be. Parenthood was no longer just an idea. The months of worry about labor, it all felt small in comparison to the emotional weight of knowing that I had given birth to a new life. The police have come at night. There's been an incident with the Polish guy, the one who was quiet but would giggle and sneer during the television ads. He's sitting straight up on the gurney. His hands are in restraints. He isn't fighting. A squad of police surround the bed. I think I see spots of blood on the floor. We've been directed to stay on one side of the hallway. The workers are watching from the glass enclosure. The residents look on. There is silence. The returners seem to know what happened, but no one asks. Will says, "Well, I'm not surprised." And when I look the next morning, the floors are clean. The time passes in a daze. Jenny leaves. She hugs each of us and gives me her leftover toothpaste. I am grateful. I ask to be moved to a double room. The Olympics have started in Korea, and every time the ads and commentary start, I can feel the others' eyes on me. I hear someone say the word spy, and I wonder if they think I'm a North Korean spy. Why is she always writing in her notebook? I can feel eyes peering over my shoulder, and I start to write in small, cramped handwriting. Maybe they think I'm writing notes for the doctors. "Ooh, she's cheating on her husband," Tamira crows during a television episode. She laughs and darts her eyes over to me. I feel their eyes on me whenever there is an ad featuring an Asian woman. I start to hear footsteps behind me while I'm pacing the halls. Or am I being paranoid? Emma leans in to me. "I spit out the pills," she whispers. "They're not going to get me that way." I have noticed the medication. I didn't before, except for the dry mouth. At night, after the meds, my eyes feel heavy, and they close soon after lights out. My vision is starting to blur. I notice it when I'm writing. The words run together as though the ink is wet. I wonder if I should spit out my medication, but mine is liquid, so I take it instead. "I want to change rooms," I say to Shara, the one with curly hair and tired eyes, but who smiles no matter what. I have started to become nervous that when I open the door to my room, someone will be waiting inside. "What, baby?" She doesn't look up from her phone. I want to change rooms. I want to share a room, I say. I try to sound matter-of-fact and not paranoid. Why? She looks up from texting. The others are talking about me. It makes me feel, I wait for the right word, uncomfortable. Well, they might be talking about you, but it may be that they're jealous. She looks at me. We're acknowledging what has been unspoken. I know, I say. I understand that, but it's becoming too much. She nods at me. Remember, you can't control how others talk about you, but you can learn to stand up for yourself. I feel dejected. Perhaps I won't be given a new room. However, an hour later, one of the workers shouts, Catherine, and she gestures to the hallway. I take that as my signal to change rooms. I gather up my possessions in my arms, my notebook, my jumpers, and underwear, and I hustle to the hallway where another worker is waiting in front of my new room. I can feel my memories sharpening. The days before the psychosis are still a blur, but my sense of who I am is coming back. It's slow and unsteady, but I feel more certain in myself. I can feel myself grounded in the present, being more aware of where I am, who I am. I find myself noticing the time, noticing the walls and the chipped paintwork. I feel claustrophobic. It's a slow suffocation. I think more about the others in the ward. Do they feel the way I feel? They don't seem to question this place, like they are accustomed to the rhythm, to the waiting. We are all in this shared experience, but I wonder if they see it that way. I have a life outside, a good one. I have an identity besides the one that's been given to me here. As we sit together in the cafeteria, hunched over our plates in silence, I think about the way our paths have crossed and brought us here. If I saw Dave on the streets of New York, would I give him a second glance? Or would I cross the street to avoid him? Would I ever speak to Ali or Darren? Would I look at Tamira and think that she's not a good mother? The last thought stings with recognition and shame. Who am I to say that? What would someone say if they saw me? I'm not a good mother. James calls me a few times a day. Our conversations are becoming more normal as my sense of self returns. He is careful not to speak about what happened before. Instead, we talk about the mundane, what we ate that day, how we slept. James tells me about Cato. Cato is sleeping well. He's smiling more. He's learned to stay longer on his tummy without crying. I talk to James while twirling the cord around my finger, aware of the clicking sounds on the phone. I know that we're being recorded. I keep the conversations short so as not to take up the phone line. I decide to ask James when I'll get to leave. Do you know when I'll get to go home? I say. I really want you to come home, he says with a sigh. But it's not up to me. It's up to the doctors. I've been talking to the doctor, and she says that every time she sees you, you seem better. The doctor? I haven't been seeing a doctor, have I? Oh, I realize. She must be watching me. I look over at the glass enclosure behind me. They are still looking down at their screens, shuffling papers. They seem to take no notice of me. Oh, I say, I feel cold. Well, I try to laugh. That's good to know. When I hang up with James, my mind is catching up. How have I been so slow? Of course I'm being watched. I'm a patient. They've been watching me all along. What am I supposed to do? What is supposed to happen? Am I acting in the correct way? Do I look sane? Should I not be writing in my notebook? I try to picture myself, viewing myself in a mirror. I'm neatly dressed, although I'm wearing a hoodie and pajamas. I wonder if I look too calm about being separated from my son. Shouldn't I be eager to go home? Shouldn't I be hysterical? I decide to remain as calm as possible. The fastest way out of here is to act like you don't want to leave. Will's words echo to me. I start to notice the workers looking at me, their eyes following me as I walk by, as I pace. Are they texting about me? What are they saying? I try not to notice the eyes that are watching. I start to think of things I miss from home. Home is a place I can imagine. I picture it in my mind, our flat in London. The objects that didn't seem so special before now seem so dear. It's as though my sense of focus is expanding. The things that had been in shadow before are taking shape, and I am slowly becoming aware. Aware of something more than just the present moment. The medication in the plastic cups, the pacing in my blue foam slippers, the sound of the television. I make a list of things I miss. I promise myself not to take them for granted again. Hot showers, tea with honey, listening to the radio, a glass of red wine, books, walks around the city, soft bedsheets, holding hands with James. I know that I should miss Cato, but my mind is still blank when I think of him. Cato's name comes up in my notebook more as I'm writing. His absence feels palpable to me. Thinking of him is like trying to capture an echo. I keep the pictures that James printed for me tucked in the back of my notebook. I keep them secret. I don't want the others to see. Every so often, I go to my room and look at them. I test myself by closing my eyes and trying to picture Cato's face. It doesn't work. I see nothing. And so I open my eyes and look at the baby in the photos. I still don't recognize him. I remember I thought that his eyes were like oceans, and I stare and stare at his eyes until his face becomes distorted and no longer looks human. I try to remember what it feels like to hold him in my arms, to remember what it sounds like when he cries. All I feel is blankness, no longing, no sadness, just the awareness that there is an absence. Maybe it's the medication, I think. In a way, it makes me feel grateful, because even though I feel numb, I can sense that it's a wound, and I have no idea how deep it goes. One of the photos is difficult to look at. I keep it behind the others because it makes me feel even more hollow. It's a photo of Cato and me. He is sleeping in my arms. The woman, me, I have to remind myself, looks eager and bright. There are tired smudges under my eyes, but my eyes are clear, and my face looks like it's shining. In my arms, the baby leans against me, his eyes closed, his face is a curve. I trace the scar on my stomach, thin and slightly curved, a ridge along my hip bone. It's the proof that Cato is real, that he did come from my body. I am a mother. I try to remember what it felt like to take care of another human being, but I can't imagine it now. It seems impossible. When I leave this place, I will be with him. I don't know why, but instead of being comforting, the thought frightens me. The thought occurs to me that maybe I'm meant to be here. I had never considered that before. Am I not sane? Even asking that question, doesn't it prove my sanity? I start to feel short of breath. This idea of who I am, does that even exist? Am I real? I am real. I know I am real. I take out my paper of truths. It's folded and creased now. The paper is rubbed smooth from where my fingers have traced the letters. My talisman reminds me of the time that Leah took me to a fortune teller. She said it was important because it was the year of the tiger, my year, which was inauspicious. She had bought a charm for me on a gold chain, a medallion stamped with an ox. It would be a charm against misfortune, she said. I wore the necklace where it stayed around my neck like a brand between my collarbones, the metal cool despite the humidity. The fortune teller was a thin man, balding with glasses. His office was in what seemed to be his flat, a large room lined by shelves of books. He had carefully taken out a piece of paper and had me write down my birth date. His English was broken, and so he spoke through Leah and gestured with his hands. Korean, he said. Koreans are sad people. He pointed to the TV in his room. Yes, Korean dramas, I said. They are sad. He drew diagrams on the piece of paper, telling me which numbers to avoid. He told me that my elements were fire and earth. He told me to balance my yang, that I should be careful not to eat hot, cold foods like lychee or melon. He told me that I should never live by the water, that I should avoid the ocean. So I was not like my grandmother, I thought. He looked at my palms and shook his head. Palms change, he said. Destinies change. I thought he would tell me whether I would marry well or have many children. Instead, he closed his book firmly. He looked at Leah, who was fidgeting with her gold watch. He looked me hard in the eyes, and I felt exposed, like he knew that I had been crying the night before. I met his gaze, and he wrote a few characters on the piece of paper and told me in English to keep it with me always. I wonder what he would say now. My first days out of the hospital, I was focused fully on Cato. The weight of responsibility, it felt heavy. Each moment and action was focused on him and keeping him safe from harm, keeping him alive. I watched our apartment transform into a baby station, corners spilling over with scattered nappies and muslins. Cato's cries filled the rooms. There was nowhere to escape it. His screams were insistent and primal and drowned out all other thought. Cato had no sense of night and day, and so we started to think of time in sets of tasks. Feed, change, sleep. Feed, change, sleep. It was sets of three, cycles that we had to repeat, again and again, like military drills. We didn't have a chance to reflect or take anything in. When he slept, we waited and tried to re-energize, knowing that the cycle would begin again. My only moment away from Cato was an hour I would take in the evenings after I fed him. I would hand Cato to James and escape to the bath, where I would soak in the hot water and close my eyes and dream of silence. That hour was precious. It was my time to be alone, to think, to remember that I had a self, that I was something more than a mother. But more than a mother wasn't really accurate. I was a mother. I was still trying to figure out what that meant. Was it a full identity that encapsulated me? Was it a shadow that followed me? A word in parentheses after my name? Was it something that I could slip on and off like a dress? I wasn't sure. My identity, my existence had shifted without me realizing it. The axis of my world had changed. Everything was now in relation to this other life. "Hi, Mum," the midwives would say to me on their visits, and I would realize with a start that they were talking to me. My sense of those days was exhaustion. The physicality of it erased my emotional senses. Why did no one talk about how tiring it was? Or had they, and I just hadn't been paying attention? We did have moments of lightness. We read Cato nursery rhymes and wondered at his hands, his small feet. We took Cato with us to the pub, walking through the frigid air, smiling as strangers cooed at us, at this tiny baby wrapped in our arms. My mother came over when Cato was a couple of weeks old. She flew in from Virginia and came to our apartment from Heathrow on her own. I remember that I was lying on the bed while Cato was in the cot next to me. We heard a knock at the door, and my mother rushed into the room. "Oh," she gasped. She clapped her hands. Her delight was childlike and pure, and it made me feel like everything was worth it. She immediately settled in to make me seaweed soup so that I could regain my strength, and she scolded us for leaving the apartment and not staying indoors. Why wasn't I wearing socks? I should be keeping my body warm, she scolded. Didn't I know anything? Should I hang some peppers at the door? I asked jokingly. She only laughed, but she watched me to make sure that I finished my seaweed soup. She stayed for 2 weeks, taking over the night watch, sleeping on the floor next to Cato's cot to hand him to me when it was time for him to feed. She brushed away tears when she said bye to Cato, leaving him with a kiss on the forehead like a fairy godmother's blessing. When my mother left, my heart ached for her. Mother, I had a new understanding of the word. Ever since I had found out I was pregnant, I had had the idea of taking a long trip to the U.S. It would be the perfect opportunity, I thought. James and I would share our parental leave, and we could see our family and friends. James was reluctant, but I was insistent. We would never have this opportunity again, I said. I had planned it perfectly and in detail. We would begin with a friend's wedding, make our way to James's family on the West Coast, and then to Virginia to see my parents, and then to New Jersey to meet the rest of James's family and my friends from New York. We would leave after Christmas, a few days before New Year's Eve. We still had time to spend in London, and I was determined to enjoy the moments we had with Cato. Before James went to work, I would set up my seat on the sofa. I called it my battle station. There were pillows, a tower of snacks, a large tumbler of water with a straw, an iPad, a phone charger, everything within arm's reach. And then I would settle in, strapped into my breastfeeding pillow, with Cato lying on me, while I watched Netflix and breastfed. There were some days when James would come back from work and find me in the same position, unable to move because Cato had been feeding all day. I didn't mind those hours while James was at work. There was something about sitting with Cato. It was like he was still tethered to me. I would stare at him, at the curve of his cheek, and feel the warmth of his body against mine. I loved the way his mouth would turn upwards into a small smile when he was sleeping, and I would touch his eyelashes with one finger. He had come from me, from my body, I would think. It was a miracle. I don't know if I would describe what I felt as love. It was something beyond that. It was more primal, a fierce, possessive affection. He was ours. He was mine. When James came home, he would sing as he held Cato. "It's the three of us, Cato, Amma, and Appa. The three of us are one family." And it was true. It was the three of us. When James's parents heard about my plan for a cross-country trip with the baby, they were particularly concerned. It unleashed a firestorm of text messages. It was dangerous to fly with a baby. It was dangerous to travel during flu season. It was dangerous to take him to a wedding where there was a crowd of people. How could we be so reckless? Didn't we care about the baby's health? I was frustrated. It seemed so backward. "If they think we're going to stay indoors for 100 days, they're mistaken," I said to James. James agreed with me, but he had his own concerns about traveling to the U.S. "You don't think it'll be too much?" he asked. "No," I said. "It'll be great. It'll be so special for Cato to meet everyone. This is the one chance we'll have to do something like this." And because of my excitement, he reluctantly gave way. As we boarded the plane to San Diego, I didn't feel any sense of foreboding, just expectation. They would understand, I thought. Once they saw him, our families would be glad that we came. We landed in San Diego the day before New Year's Eve. The air felt expectant, rich with the smell of palm trees and coconut. We stayed in a resort off the coast. We were celebrating the wedding of two friends of mine from college who had been together for 12 years. Cato didn't notice the time change, and for once the jet lag didn't matter. Our cycle continued on. Feed, change, sleep. Feed, change, sleep. I expressed milk into plastic bags that I had brought and kept them in a freezable lunchbox that James carried with him. At night in the hotel, Cato would scream and scream, and so I cradled him in my arms and sang lullabies until he fell asleep. The theme of the wedding was a New Year's Eve party. The scent of salt water and freesias was in the air. I was a bridesmaid, and I wore a dress lined in sequins with metallic thread. Cato was curled in my husband's arms like a snail, sleeping in the sling. We brought in the new year in a cloud of confetti. At the harbor, the groom sobbed through his vows, and we cried along with him. We danced with Cato in our arms. We cheered as we lit sparklers in the night, and the groomsmen hoisted chairs holding the bride and groom. Through the glitter, I thought of another evening, in another lifetime, in Hong Kong. That night on the balcony, looking for stars, things had seemed so hopeless. Why had I thought that that type of love was the only kind I deserved? I looked at Cato in my arms, his hands pressed against me, and I felt triumphant, a desperate feeling of love, of joy. I felt renewed. I had heard once that most of the cells in our body regenerate every 7 to 15 years, and so we become new, but with some parts deep within that will never be replaced. Still, it made me think of being a new creature, cleansed. How lucky, we thought, that Cato got to witness the celebration, to bring in a new year of love. As we watched the bride and groom perform the tea ceremony, the bowing to their parents, the offerings to the ancestors, it also felt serendipitous. Cato was our lucky charm. I am thinking of Cato's 100-day celebration. It was meant to take place by the water. James's mother had booked a seafood restaurant with a view of New York City. From the tables, you can see the ferries and boats go by. We had ordered sticky rice cakes, boxes of fruits, a tower of red dates to represent abundance. Cato was going to wear a silk hanbok, dark blue and pink with embroidered gold lettering. I had spent an afternoon at a New Jersey party store looking at the sparkling balloons and party hats. I had bought colorful paper bunting, streamers of ribbons, straws with pineapples on them, emoji stickers for the party favors. It all seemed so superficial now, the scraps of plastic and paper. Thinking of the party, I feel a deep sense of guilt. What were we celebrating? Had I tempted the fates by being too reckless? My grandmother would have been stern with me. When you have something precious, something to rejoice in, you hide away. Everyone knew that. I had been too careless, too loud in my happiness, and now we were all being punished. It was the balancing. Even in the ward, I can't escape my feelings of guilt. Catherine? I'm coloring with Darren. He's working on a picture of a leopard, and I have one of a unicorn. It's Christine, the social worker. Everyone knows who she is. Whenever she leaves the glass enclosure, she's immediately trailed by residents. They follow her from room to room. Christine, Christine, they call. She ignores them. She usually looks frazzled. She looks nervous now. Come with me, she says, and I follow her into the activity room. I can feel the eyes of the others following me. Christine is wearing a crocheted pink beanie, and she bites her lip when she talks to me. I try to remember to act naturally. I sit carefully, but then I pause. No, I shouldn't sit too carefully. I don't want to seem posed. Will she be able to decide when I get to leave, or is it just the doctors? I try to picture what I must look like, with my glasses and carefully tied hair and hoodie. She has a binder next to her. I wonder what it says about me. We sit and look at one another. She doesn't meet my eyes completely. She looks beyond them. So, she says. She smiles at me. I smile back, but not too widely. We could be two people sitting for a business meeting. How are you feeling? Good, I say. I feel good. She starts to flip through the binder. Your husband provided a lot of paperwork for us. He's been very, she pauses, involved. I smile. That's his personality, I say. He's very thorough. I wonder what exactly he's provided for them. I see his annotations and notes in the margins. She nods. Do you have any questions for me? She asks. I want to ask when I can leave, but I think of Will's words, and so I start with another question first. I want to know what meds I'm on, I say. Okay, so looking at your file, you're on haloperidol and Benadryl. I've never heard of haloperidol. Haloperidol is an antipsychotic. Christine seems to guess my thoughts. Benadryl, I ask. I think it's to shut down your milk production, she says. She says it without emotion. She waits for me to say something. I want to know when I can leave, I say. The room seems to change. I feel Christine stiffen, but I try to look nonchalant. When do you think you'll be able to leave? She asks. I'm not sure, I say. I think it's up to the doctors. I remember at the end to phrase it as a question. Christine immediately waves her hands. Oh, but it's not up to the doctors. It's up to you. It's up to us working together as a team. Your husband, me, you, we're all a team. So we're going to work on it together, she says. I'm not sure what that means, but I try to stay calm. Our meeting is interrupted by Dave, who is slamming his wheelchair against the door. I need to speak to you, he says. I see you've been discussing things with my paralegal, but it's time for you to talk to me. Christine sighs. She nods at me. I realize that I've been dismissed. And then what? I pace the hallways, trying to breathe. I am still pacing, back and forth along the corridors, when Will comes up to me. He's wearing faded sweatpants and a patched hoodie. You saw Christine, he says. He looks at me kindly. I think he's going to make a joke, or maybe tell me I've got it easy compared to him when he's so desperate to stay. Instead, he smiles. I have an apple in my room, if you want one, he says. I recognize the care of the gesture. I nod. Thank you, I say. He half jogs to his room and returns with an apple in his hand. One of the workers is frowning after him. Here, he says. Don't worry, they won't care as long as you don't eat it in front of the others. It's tart and slightly warm, but it reminds me of sunshine. Will looks at me appraisingly. You'll be all right, he says. You got people. Yes, I think. I do. And as I savor the apple, I think of James and the evenings when I was pregnant, sitting at the kitchen table, cutting apples together, the peel unfurling like a globe. We'd talk about the future with hope, with expectation. Everything had seemed within our reach, just like the apples in our hands. What am I doing here? I want to be home. I want to be with James. I want to be with Cato. The yearning is so sharp, I want to collapse, to sit on the floor and weep. Will is watching me, a sympathetic half-smile on his face, but I don't weep. Instead, I think of the hidden star in the apple in my hands. Teddy and I would clap our hands when my mother cut the fruit horizontally to reveal it. To think, a star had been waiting, just for us. After San Diego, the next stop on our U.S. trip was L.A. We arrived there when fires were raging across the landscape. It was New Year's Day. James's older brother, Matt, lived in a suburb in a beautiful house made of white stone that had been constructed a year before. You go in and you pick out what house you want, Matt had said. Each house in the subdivision was a variation on the model houses at the entrance. Their house had swooping ceilings, and everything was white, the furniture, the linen, the floors, the kitchen island. It felt beautiful, if sterile. The neighborhood was an unending reflection of white. White box houses that had the same doors and windows, with a fingertip of space separating them. My brother-in-law is a doctor. He has a type of charm that's loud, brash, full of swagger. His wife is a nurse, tall and pretty, with a soft voice. Her name is Grace, but James and I call her Hyungsunim, meaning older brother's wife, the Nim signifying honor. I knew they didn't think that we should have been traveling with a baby. You should eat some seaweed soup, my sister-in-law said as a greeting. James's aunt threw a New Year's party for us. The house was full of cousins, aunts and uncles, the West Coast side of James's family clan. We drank rice cake soup and ate sticky sesame cakes for good luck. I met James's grandfather for the first time. He was 102 years old, with white hair and faded eyes. His eyes reminded me of James's eyes, and they had the same smile. He was sitting at the table with a bowl of rice cake soup. Grandfather, James said. His grandfather turned to us. I could tell he was confused for a moment, and I wondered how he felt, all these children running around the house. But he smiled at us and stroked Cato's cheek, and he looked at me as though he recognized me from a distant past. We held his hands, and Cato reached for his cheek. After dinner, we lined up according to age and bowed to James's grandfather for good fortune in the new year. First, James's aunts and uncles, and then the cousins, and then finally the cousins' children. Each time he smiled and waved his hands over us, as his descendants came to him in waves. We walked to him and pressed our foreheads to the ground. I felt my head touch the floor, and I thought of all the generations who had done this for centuries before. James's grandfather pressed dollar bills into the children's hands, shaking his head when they tried to refuse. It made me think of my grandmother. She would always put money into my hands when we left her house, and my mother would make me give it back, only for us to find it tucked into my pockets later. "Buy something to eat," my grandmother would say. As we left, James's grandfather waved at us, beaming. We spent our days in a coffee shop across the road from Matt's house. James was still working remotely, and so he was logging on to his computer and drawing up plans for research, talking with his students. Matt and Grace left early in the mornings for their work shifts. We didn't have a car, so we walked each morning along the highway to the coffee shop. We sat in the courtyard while James worked over a cup of coffee. I had Cato strapped to me, breathing in the California sun. Cato would snore, his face pressed against my body. I would look down, and I could see his cheek pressed against me, his fist a tight curl against my skin. When the sun started to get too hot, we would go back to the house. The white was cool, a refuge from the heat. I was still breastfeeding, but I developed thrush, so I walked around the house with my shirt around my waist, airing out my breasts to get rid of it. We would later find out that the entire house was nest cammed, with motion detector audio and visual surveillance cameras. "It's a California thing," Matt said. He said it was for home security. James was furious, but I could only laugh. It made me nervous, though, and I started to notice the blinking of lights in the corners, cameras in the rafters. I started to monitor what I said to James. I felt like we were being watched. On our third day, I developed mastitis, an infection because of blocked milk ducts in the breast, and so I became bedbound with Cato next to me. The cure to mastitis was to keep breastfeeding, so I kept him close. He was again my fellow inmate. I felt trapped in the white room, unable to leave because I couldn't fasten my clothes without feeling pain. Cato didn't seem to mind. He didn't cry. Instead, he slept soundly, his cheek pressed against the white sheets. I would lie on my side and shiver because of the fever, and I would watch him sleep. I would trace the lines of his eyes, the curve of his cheek, his dark hair in the sun. Time didn't seem to matter anymore. Cato was either feeding or not feeding, and I would slip in and out of consciousness. James would bring ice water. The ice cubes would dissolve in the heat, and I would stare at the white walls and wonder how much time had passed. I would whisper stories to Cato and sing him the songs I remembered, the ones about a mockingbird and diamond rings, and the Korean one about elephants and blue moons, and I would watch as his eyes would crinkle, and I would let him wrap his hand around my finger and marvel at the strength of his grip. James tried to shut off the camera monitors, but it was a complicated procedure, and he ended up covering as many as he could with pieces of white paper. At night, James and Cato would sleep, but I would lie awake. I started to hear the sounds of the cameras whirring. In the fairy tale of Shim Cheung, after Shim Cheung decides to sell herself as a sacrifice to the sea god, she lies to her blind father, telling him that she is going away. She cries silently and makes sure that he can't feel the wet of tears on her cheek. The sea is stormy, and the fishermen tie an anchor around Shim Cheung's feet so that she will sink quickly, a merciful death instead of struggle. There is lightning, thunder, the waves come fast and hard, and she is thrown overboard. But then, a miracle. She finds herself in the underwater sea kingdom, and she is crowned queen. Queen of the sea, with pearls like tears around her neck. I always wondered about this fairy tale, that moment before being thrown into the sea. I believe she has tears, but I think it's only because she won't see her father again. She has surrendered to the fates, and she feels triumphant in her sacrifice. The divers in Korea are always women. They swim along the coast, diving to deep depths without any breathing equipment. They ignore the dangers of the strong currents, providing for their families by collecting abalone from the seafloor. I wonder if they think of Shim Cheung as they dive deep beneath the waves. I used to imagine they would find pearls, pearls like tears, gifts from the Queen of the Sea. We arrived in Virginia during a blizzard. I had been apprehensive about Virginia, mostly because I wasn't sure what to expect when we saw my father. When James had texted a photo of Cato to announce our son had been born, my father had texted back, "Okay." I couldn't imagine my father with a baby. Would he be distant? Would he be irritated by Cato's crying? We stepped up to the front door. My mother opened it and embraced me. My father was standing behind her, hesitant. I saw his face. He looked eager. "Here," I said, and held Cato out to him. "Ah," he said. He reached out his arms and held Cato close. His glasses slipped off his nose. He was face to face with him. And then he smiled a full smile. "Hello," he said, as though Cato was an adult. My father took Cato to the piano and played the opening notes of a Bach prelude. For the rest of our time in Virginia, if Cato wasn't feeding, he was in my father's arms. My ever thrifty parents had transformed a large cardboard box into Cato's cot. My father had drawn cartoon characters, slightly wobbly Disney faces, and Hagar the Horrible. It made me remember my father in restaurants, drawing lines on napkins with a fountain pen, while we watched as the lines transformed into cartoon faces. I hadn't thought of that memory for years. We took Cato on walks in the woods, through the park area where the snow was falling in banks and drifts. He looked up in wonder at the light shining through the trees, at the gray of the sky, the pattern of the leaves. And I thought what he must feel, looking at the world turned around. We spent those few weeks in silence. Even Cato seemed to know that it was a quiet house. He didn't cry much during the day, but at night he refused to sleep, and I would stay awake with him, curled next to me in the bed, the two of us, silently listening to the creaking of the walls, the sounds of night. He would cry quietly into my shoulder, and I would try to soothe him to sleep. My father would knock on my door each morning and take Cato from me so that I could have a few more hours of sleep. I would come downstairs, and my father would be lying on the couch, with Cato sleeping on top of him. Cato's head was tucked against my father's chin, and his cheek was pressed against my father's chest. My father was gazing at the ceiling, his arms curled around Cato. They were still, separate from the world. It made me wonder at how my father must have held Teddy and me when we were small. What had changed? What had gone wrong? Teddy came to Virginia to meet Cato. His hair brushed his shoulders, and he looked more like my mother's son than ever. I had to erase the memory of a dimple-cheeked boy who would follow me around. He was uncertain around Cato, and patted him gingerly with one hand, as though he was afraid Cato would break. I realized that my family expected me to act a certain way as a mother. "You can't do whatever you want now," my mother said to me sternly when I told her that I wanted to leave the house. "You have to think of Jihoon." She always called him by his Korean name. Yes, I did think of Cato. I thought of Cato every moment. "You shouldn't even be here," my mother scolded, but she said it while smiling. I knew she was happy to see Cato. She sighed. "What must your in-laws think?" "Catherine?" It's one of the doctors from behind the glass enclosure. I am in the TV room, writing in my notebook. I follow her into the cafeteria. I try to be calm. Maybe I can leave. She is slight with dark hair. She has glasses that slip off her nose. I notice that the rest of her face is blurred. "So," she says, "I know you spoke to Christine." Her hands are fidgeting, and she's looking past me at the clock behind my shoulder. "How are you feeling?" she asks. "I feel good," I say. I see her look at me appraisingly. Maybe she can tell that I can't make out her face. "You've been very unwell," she says. "Are you sleeping?" she asks. I nod. She is watching me. I try not to fidget. "I'd like to know how I can go home," I say. I try not to sound eager. I try to sound measured. She waits for me to keep talking and even though I want to, I don't. I wait. Well, she says finally, only you know when you're ready to go home. I don't understand what that means, I say. It means exactly what it sounds like. We've spoken to your husband. He feels like you're still not completely yourself. My annoyance shows. He's a perfectionist, I say. I feel fine. I'm basically 100%. But I've said it too forcefully, I can tell. Don't worry, Catherine. It's about how you feel, not someone else's perception of how you feel. We listen to you. I sit back. She isn't listening. Are you eager to leave? She asks. Of course, I think. Of course. Not too eager. I pause carefully. I miss my family and would like to go home. Well, let's wait another day or two. Let's see how you feel. I force myself to smile calmly. Great, I say. What does it mean that James doesn't think I'm myself? I can't remember what it feels like to be myself before all of this, whatever it means. I am feeling something like rage, but a dampened one. Somewhere there's an emotion, but I'm only feeling the echo of it. I'm suffocating in this place, trapped within these hallways of repeating walls. Does James not trust me? Does he think I should stay here? I feel helpless. I want to scream, but I don't. I want to use the phone. I want to call James, but when I lift the phone, there's no dial tone. The phone is heavy in my hand. It's not phone time. So instead, I pace, back and forth. My slippers are soft against the linoleum floor. I try to time my breathing with each footstep, a few counts for each breath, in and out. I am trying to remember to keep the inhales as long as the exhales. No panic, just deep breaths that fill my body with air.